This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Lean Thinking, Banish Waste, and Create Wealth in Your Corporation, Second Edition, by James P. Womack and Daniel T. Jones. Read by James P. Womack.
Lean Thinking was first published in the fall of 1996, just in time, we thought, for the recession of 1997 and the financial meltdown of 1998. Our mission was to explain how to get beyond the financial games of the 1990s to create real lasting value in any business. Toward this end, our key examples show how a range of firms took advantage of the recession of 1991 to rethink their strategies and embark on a new path. In our presentations to industrial audiences, we often point out that the only sure thing about forecasts is that they are wrong, which is why lean thinkers strive to reduce order-to-delivery times to such an extent that most products can be made to order, and always try to add or subtract capacity in small increments. As it turned out, the accuracy of our own economic forecast was consistent with our observations about forecast. Instead of a recession in 1997, the most ebullient economy of the entire 20th century charged ahead for 5 more years, into 2001, extending a remarkable era in which practically anyone could succeed in business. Given that lean thinking was launched so far ahead of its greatest need, it's surprising how many people took our advice seriously during the best of times. More than 300,000 copies have been sold in English, along with German, French, Italian, Portuguese, Polish, Turkish, Korean, Japanese, and Chinese translations. We have heard from readers and listeners across the world about their successes in applying its principles. What's not surprising is that once reality caught up with our forecast, and the recession of 2001 gave way to the financial meltdown of 2002, reader and listener interest surged. Indeed, lean thinking reappeared on the Business Week Business Books bestseller list in 2001, nearly 5 years after its launch and with no publicity campaign, an occurrence that our publishers report as unprecedented. Given clear evidence that readers are now finding lean thinking even more relevant in their business lives than when it was first published, we have decided to expand and reissue the book. As economies have gyrated, stock markets crashed, and the poster companies of the 1990s, Hale and other business books, have flown a ballistic trajectory, our lean exemplars, led by Toyota, have defied the fate of most firms featured in successful business books. They have continued their methodical march from success to success and have done it the hard way by creating real and truly sustainable value for their customers, their employees, and their owners. Today, nearly 7 years after its publication, we are even more certain that lean thinking is the single most powerful tool available for creating value while eliminating waste in any organization. We hope that previous listeners will use this new edition as an opportunity to renew their commitment to lean principles. And we especially hope that many new listeners will discover a whole new world of opportunity. Lean principles. Lean thinking versus Muda. Muda. It's the one word of Japanese you really must know. It sounds awful as it rolls off your tongue, and it should, because Muda means waste, specifically any human activity which absorbs resources but creates no value, mistakes which require rectification, production of items no one wants so that inventories and remaindered goods pile up, processing steps which aren't actually needed, movement of employees and transport of goods from one place to another without any purpose, groups of people in a downstream activity standing around waiting because an upstream activity has not delivered on time, and goods and services which don't meet the needs of the customer. Taichi Ono, the Toyota executive who was the most ferocious foe of waste human history has produced, identified the first 7 types of Muda described above, and we've added the final one. Perhaps there are even more. But however many varieties of mudita there may be, it's hard to dispute, from even the most casual observation of what gets done in an average day in the average organization, that mudita is everywhere. What's more, as you learn to see mudita, you will discover that there is even more around than you ever dreamed. Fortunately, there's a powerful antidote to mudita, lean thinking. It provides a way to specify value, line up value-creating actions in the best sequence, conduct these activities without interruption whenever someone requests them, and perform them more and more effectively. In short, lean thinking is lean because it provides a way to do more and more with less and less. Less human effort, less equipment, less time, and less space, while coming closer and closer to providing customers with exactly what they want. Lean thinking also provides a way to make work more satisfying by providing immediate feedback on efforts to convert mudita into value. And in striking contrast with the recent craze for process reengineering, it provides a way to create new work rather than simply destroying jobs in the name of efficiency. Specify value. Critical starting point for lean thinking is value. Value can only be defined by the ultimate customer. And it's only meaningful when expressed in terms of a specific product, a good or a service, and often both at once, which meets the customer's needs at a specific price at a specific time. Value is created by the producer. From the customer's standpoint, this is why producers exist. Yet for a host of reasons, value is very hard for producers to accurately define. Business school-trained senior executives of American firms routinely greet us when we visit with a slick presentation about their organization, their technology, their core competencies, and their strategic intentions. Then, over lunch, they tell us about their short-term competitive problems, specifically their need to garner adequate profits in the next quarter, and the consequent cost-cutting initiatives. These often involve clever ways to eliminate jobs, divert revenues from their downstream customers, and extract profits from their upstream suppliers. Because we are associated with the concept of lean production, they are usually eager to label these programs lean, although often they are only mean. By dessert, we may be hearing about their personal career issues in the current age of downsizing. What only comes up when we push it to the foreground is the specific products the firm expects specific customers to purchase at a specific price to keep the company in business, and how the performance and delivered quality of these products can be improved while their fundamental costs are pushed steadily down. In raising this issue, it's often revealing to ask these executives a simple question. Can you put yourself in the position of a design as it progresses from concept to launch? An order, as information flows from initial request to delivered product? The physical product as it progresses from raw material to the customer? Can you describe what will happen at each step along the way? Usually there's an awkward silence, and then, if we aren't persistent, these issues quickly slip out of sight to be replaced once more by aggregated financial considerations. In short, the immediate needs of the shareholder and the financial mindset of the senior managers have taken precedence over the day-to-day realities of specifying and creating value for the customer. Managers everywhere tend to say, "This product is what we know how to produce using assets we've already bought, so if customers don't respond, we'll adjust the price or add bells and whistles." What they should be doing instead is fundamentally rethinking value from the perspective of the customer. One of the best and most exasperating illustrations of this backwards thought process is the current-day airline industry. As frequent users of this service, we have long been keeping detailed notes on our experiences and contrasting our own definition of value with that proposed by most companies in this industry. Our value equation is very simple. To get from where we are to where we want to be safely and with the least hassle at a reasonable price. By contrast, the airline's definition seems to involve using their existing assets in the most efficient manner, even if we have to visit Timbuktu to get anywhere. They then throw in added features, like executive lounges in their hubs and elaborate entertainment systems in every seat, in hopes the inconvenience will be tolerable. The end result of over 20 years of this type of thinking in the United States is that passengers are miserable. This is not what they mean by value. The aircraft producers make little money because airlines can't afford new planes, and the airlines, excepting Southwest and a few other startups pursuing the more sensible strategy of flying point to point, although still using large aircraft, have flown a holding pattern in the vicinity of bankruptcy. Lean thinking, therefore, must start with a conscious attempt to precisely define value in terms of specific products with specific capabilities offered at specific prices through a dialogue with specific customers. The way to do this is to ignore existing assets and technologies and to rethink firms on a product line basis with strong, dedicated product teams. This also requires redefining the role for a firm's technical experts and rethinking just where in the world to create value. Realistically, no manager can actually implement all of these changes instantly, but it's essential to form a clear view of what's really needed. Otherwise, the definition of value is almost certain to be skewed. In summary, specifying value accurately is the critical first step in lean thinking. Providing the wrong good or service the right way is muda. Identify the value stream. The value stream is the set of all the specific actions required to bring a specific product, whether a good, a service, or increasingly a combination of the two, through the three critical management tasks of any business. The problem-solving task running from concept through detailed design and engineering to production launch. The information management task running from order taking through detailed scheduling to delivery. And the physical transformation task proceeding from raw materials to a finished product in the hands of the customer. Identifying the entire value stream for each product, or in some cases for each product family, is the next step in lean thinking, a step which firms have rarely attempted but which almost always exposes enormous, indeed staggering, amounts of muda. Specifically, the value stream analysis will almost always show that three types of actions are occurring along the value stream. First, many steps will be found to unambiguously create value. Welding the tubes of a bicycle frame together, or flying a passenger from Dayton to Des Moines. Second, many other steps will be found to create no value, but to be unavoidable with current technologies and production assets, inspecting wells to ensure quality, and the extra step of flying large planes through the Detroit hub en route from Dayton to Des Moines. We'll term these Type 1 muda. And third, many additional steps will be found to create no value and to be immediately avoidable. Type 2 muda. For example, when Pratt & Whitney, the world's largest manufacturer of aircraft jet engines, started to map its value streams for its three families of jet engines, it discovered that activities undertaken by its raw material suppliers to produce ultra-pure metals were duplicated at great cost by the next firms downstream, the forgers who converted metal ingots into near-net shapes suitable for machining. At the same time, the initial ingot of material, for example, titanium or nickel, was 10 times the weight of the machine parts eventually fashioned from them. 90% of the very expensive metals were being scrapped because the initial ingot was poured in a massive size. The melters were certain that this was efficient, without much attention to the shape of the finished parts. And finally, the melters were preparing several different ingots, at great cost, in order to meet Pratt's precise technical requirements for each engine, which varied only marginally from those of other engine families and from the needs of competitors. Many of these activities could be eliminated almost immediately with dramatic cost savings. How could so much waste go unnoticed for decades in the supposedly sophisticated aerospace industry? Very simply, none of the four firms involved in this tributary value stream for a jet engine, the melter, the forger, the machiner, and the final assembler, had ever fully explained its activities to the other three. Partly this was a matter of confidentiality. Each firm feared that those upstream and downstream would use any information revealed to drive a harder bargain. And partly it was a matter of obliviousness. The four firms were accustomed to looking carefully at their own affairs, but had simply never taken the time to look at the whole value stream, including the consequences of their internal activities for other firms along the stream. When they did, they discovered massive waste. So lean thinking must go beyond the firm, the standard unit of scorekeeping in businesses across the world, to look at the whole. The entire set of activities entailed in creating and producing a specific product, from concept through detailed design to actual availability, from the initial sale through order entry and production scheduling to delivery, and from raw materials produced far away and out of sight, right into the hands of the customer. The organizational method for doing this is what we call the Lean Enterprise, a continuing conference of all the concerned parties to create a channel for the entire value stream, dredging away all the muda. Whenever we present this idea for the first time, audiences tend to assume that a new legal entity is needed, some formalized successor to the virtual corporation, which in reality becomes a new form of vertical integration. In fact, what is needed is the exact opposite. In an age when individual firms are outsourcing more and themselves doing less, the actual need is for a voluntary alliance of all the interested parties to oversee the disintegrated value stream, an alliance which examines every value-creating step and lasts as long as the product lasts. For products like automobiles in a specific size class, which go through successive generations of development, this might be decades. For short-lived products like software for a specific application, it might be less than a year. Creating lean enterprises does require a new way to think about firm-to-firm relations, some simple principles for regulating behavior between firms, and transparency regarding all the steps taken along the value stream so each participant can verify that the other firms are behaving in accord with the general principles. Flow. Once value has been precisely specified, the value stream for a specific product family fully mapped by the Lean Enterprise, and obviously wasteful steps eliminated, it's time for the next step in lean thinking, a truly breathtaking one. Make the remaining value-creating steps flow. However, please be warned that this step requires a complete rearrangement of your mental furniture. We are all born into a mental world of functions and departments, a common-sense conviction that activities ought to be grouped by type so they can be performed more efficiently and managed more easily. In addition to get tasks done efficiently within departments, it seems like further common sense to perform like activities in batches. In the claims department, process all of the claim A's, then the claim B's, and then the claim C's. In the paint department, paint all of the green parts, then shift over and paint all of the red parts, then do the purple ones. Batches, as it turns out, always mean long waits as the product sits patiently awaiting the department's changeover to the type of activity the product needs next. But this approach keeps the members of the department busy, all the equipment running hard, and justifies dedicated high-speed equipment. So it must be efficient, right? Actually, it's dead wrong, but hard or impossible for most of us to see. Taichi Ono blamed this batch-and-queue mode of thinking on civilization's first farmers, who he claimed lost the one-thing-at-a-time wisdom of the hunter as they became obsessed with batches, the once-a-year harvest, and inventories, the grain depository. Or perhaps we're simply born with batch thinking in our heads, along with many other common-sense illusions. For example, that time is constant rather than relative, or that space is straight rather than curved. But we all need to fight departmentalized batch thinking because tasks can almost always be accomplished much more efficiently and accurately when the product is worked on continuously from raw material to finished good. In short, things work better when you focus on the product and its needs rather than the organization or the equipment, so that all of the activities needed to design, order, and provide a product occur in continuous flow. Henry Ford and his associates were the first people to fully realize the potential of flow. Ford reduced the amount of effort required to assemble a Model T Ford by 90% during the fall of 1913 by switching to continuous flow in final assembly. Subsequently, he lined up all of the machines needed to produce the parts for a Model T in the correct sequence and tried to achieve flow all the way from raw materials to shipment of the finished car, achieving a similar productivity leap. But he only discovered the special case. His method only worked when production volumes were high enough to justify high-speed assembly lines, when every product used exactly the same parts, and when the same model was produced for many years, 19 in the case of the Model T. In the early 1920s, when Ford towered above the rest of the industrial world, his company was assembling more than 2 million Model Ts at dozens of assembly plants around the world, every one of them exactly alike. After World War II, Taiichi Ono and his technical collaborators concluded that the real challenge was to create continuous flow in small lot production when dozens or hundreds of copies of a product were needed, not millions. This is the general case because these humble streams, not the few mighty rivers, account for the great bulk of human needs. Ono and his associates achieved continuous flow in low-volume production, in most cases without assembly lines, by learning to quickly change over tools from one product to the next, and by right-sizing, miniaturizing, machines so that processing steps of different types, say molding, painting, and assembly, could be conducted immediately adjacent to each other with the object undergoing manufacture being kept in continuous flow. The benefit of doing things this way are easy to demonstrate. We've watched with our own eyes in plants in North America and Europe as lean thinkers practiced kaikaku, roughly translatable as radical improvement, in contrast with kaizen, or continuous incremental improvement. Production activities for a specific product were rearranged in a day, from departments and batches to continuous flow, with a doubling of productivity and a dramatic reduction in errors and scrap. Yet the great bulk of activities across the world are still conducted in departmentalized batch and queue fashion, 50 years after a dramatically superior way was discovered. Why? The most basic problem is that flow thinking is counterintuitive. It seems obvious to most people that work should be organized by departments in batches. Then once departments and specialized equipment for making batches at high speeds are put in place, both the career aspirations of the employees within departments and the calculations of the corporate accountant, who wants to keep expensive assets fully utilized, work powerfully against switching over to flow. The lean alternative is to redefine the work of functions, departments, and firms so they can make a positive contribution to value creation and to speak to the real needs of employees at every point along the stream so it is actually in their interest to make value flow. Pull. The first visible effect of converting from departments and batches to product teams and flow is that the time required to go from concept to launch, sale to delivery, and raw material to the customer falls dramatically. When flow is introduced, products requiring years to design are done in months, orders taking days to process are completed in hours, and the weeks or months of throughput time for conventional physical production are reduced to minutes or days. Indeed, if you can't quickly take throughput times down by half in product development, 75% in order processing, and 90% in physical production, you are doing something wrong. What's more, lean systems can make any product currently in production in any combination so that shifting demand can be accommodated immediately. So what? This produces a one-time cash windfall from inventory reduction and speeds return on investment, but is it really a revolutionary achievement? In fact, it is, because the ability to design, schedule, and make exactly what the customer wants just when the customer wants it means you can throw away the sales forecast and simply make what customers actually tell you they need. That is, you can let the customer pull the product from you as needed rather than pushing products, often unwanted, onto the customer. What's more, the demands of customers become much more stable when they know they can get what they want right away and when producers stop periodic price discounting campaigns designed to move goods already made, which no one wants. Let's take a practical example, book publishing. One half of the books printed in the United States each year are shredded without ever finding a reader. How can this be? Because publishers and the printing and distribution firms they work with along the value stream have never learned about flow, so the customer can't pull. It takes many weeks to reorder books if the bookseller or warehouse runs out of stock, yet the shelf life of most books is very short. Publishers must either sell the book at the peak of reader interest or forego many sales. Because the publisher can't accurately predict demand in advance, the only solution is to print thousands of copies to fill the channel when the book is launched, even though only a few thousand copies of the average book will be sold. The rest are then returned to the publisher and scrapped when the selling season is over. The solution to this problem will probably emerge in phases. In the next few years, printing firms can learn to quickly print up small lots of books, and distribution warehouses can learn to replenish bookstore shelves frequently. Eventually, new right-sized book printing technologies may make it possible to simply print out the books the customer wants at the moment the customer asks for them, either in a bookstore or, even better, in the customer's office or home. And some customers may not want a physical copy of their book at all. Instead, they will request the electronic transfer of the text from the publisher to their own computer, printing out an old-fashioned paper version only if they happen to need it. The appropriate solution will be found once the members of the publishing value stream embrace the fourth principle of lean thinking, pull. Perfection. As organizations begin to accurately specify value, identify the entire value stream, make the value-creating steps for specific products flow continuously, let the customer pull value from the enterprise, something very odd begins to happen. It dawns on those involved that there is no end to the process of reducing effort, time, space, cost, and mistakes while offering a product which is ever more nearly what the customer actually wants. Suddenly, perfection, the fifth and final principle of lean thinking, doesn't seem like a crazy idea. Why should this be? Because the four initial principles interact with each other in a virtuous circle. Getting value to flow faster always exposes hidden muddha in the value stream. And the harder you pull, the more the impediments to flow are revealed so they can be removed. Dedicated product teams and direct dialogue with customers always find ways to specify value more accurately and often learns of ways to enhance flow and pull as well. Perhaps the most important spur to perfection is transparency. The fact that in a lean system, everyone, subcontractors, first-tier suppliers, system integrators, often called assemblers, distributors, customers, employees, can see everything, and so it's easy to discover better ways to create value. What's more, there is nearly instant and highly positive feedback for employees making improvements, a key feature of lean work and a powerful spur to continuing efforts to improve. Readers familiar with the open book management movement in the United States will recall that financial transparency and immediate feedback on results in the form of monetary bonuses for employees are its central elements. Thus, there is a broad consistency between our approach and theirs. However, a major question emerges for open book managers as finances are made transparent and employees are rewarded for performance. How can performance be improved? Sweat and longer hours are not the answer, but will be employed if no one knows how to work smarter. The techniques for flow and pull that we will be describing are the answer. What's more, when employees begin to feel the immediate feedback from making product development, order taking, and production flow, and are able to see the customer's satisfaction, much of the carrot and stick apparatus of open book management's financial reward system becomes unnecessary. The prize we can grasp now. Dreaming about perfection is fun. It's also useful because it shows what is possible and helps us to achieve more than we would otherwise. However, if lean thinking makes perfection seem plausible in the long term, most of us live and work in the short term. What are the benefits of lean thinking which we can grasp right away? Based on years of benchmarking and observation in organizations around the world, we have developed the following simple rules of thumb. Converting a classic batch and queue production system to continuous flow with effective pull by the customer will double labor productivity all the way through the system for direct, managerial, and technical workers from raw materials to delivered products, while cutting production throughput times by 90% and reducing inventories in the system by 90% as well. Errors reaching the customer and scrap within the production process are typically cut in half, as are job-related injuries. Time to market for new products will be halved, and a wider variety of products within product families can be offered at very modest additional cost. What's more, the capital investments required will be very modest, even negative, if facilities and equipment can be freed up and sold. And this is just to get started. This is the Kaikaku bonus released by the initial radical realignment of the value stream. What follows is continuous improvements by means of Kaizen en route to perfection. Firms having completed the radical realignment can typically double productivity again through incremental improvements within 2 to 3 years and halve again inventories, errors, and lead times during this period. And then the combination of Kaikaku and Kaizen can produce endless improvements. Getting started. Because lean thinking is counterintuitive and a bit difficult to grasp on first encounter, but then blindingly obvious once the light comes on, it's very useful to examine the actual application of the 5 lean principles in real organizations. The material that follows, therefore, provides real instances of lean principles banishing Muda. The place to start, as always, is with value, as defined by the customer. Value. A house or a hassle-free experience. Doyle Wilson of Austin, Texas, had been building homes for 15 years before he got serious about quality. In October of 1991, I just got disgusted. Such a large part of my business was waiting and rework, with expensive warranty claims and friction with customers, that I knew there must be a better way. Then I stumbled across the quality movement. He read Carl Sewell's book on car dealing, Customers for Life, and decided to test his claims by buying a car at Sewell's Dallas dealership. His reasoning? I thought that if even a car dealer could make a customer feel good, it should be easy for a home builder. His purchase was such a positive experience that he asked Sewell for advice on quality in home building and was told to read the works of W. Edwards Deming. Doyle Wilson is the archetypical Texan and never does things halfway. By February of 1992, he had launched a wall-to-wall total quality campaign at Doyle Wilson Home Builder. Over the next 3 years, he personally taught his workforce the principles of TQM, began to collect and analyze enormous amounts of data on every aspect of his business, got rid of individual sales commissions, which destroy quality consciousness, eliminated the traditional builder bonus for his construction superintendents, who were qualifying for the on-time completion bonus by making side deals with customers on a to-be-done-later list, reduced his contractor corps by 2/3, and required the remaining contractors to attend and pay for his monthly quality seminars. Customer surveys showed a steady rise in satisfaction with the home building experience, and sales grew steadily even in a flat market as Wilson took sales from his competitors. Yet he was not satisfied. I knew I was making progress in competing with other builders for the new home buyer, but a simple fact once it lodged in my mind wouldn't go away. 78% of the homes bought in Central Texas each year are used, older homes. I've been making progress in increasing my share of the 22% seeking a new home, but what about the 78% who bought older homes? Obviously, these buyers are the real market opportunity. So instead of surveying people who were buying new homes, Wilson began to talk with people who were buying older homes. What he discovered was obvious in retrospect, but has required a complete rethinking of his business. Specifically, he found that many buyers of older homes hated the hassle factor. In negotiating for new construction, the long lead times to get the job done and move in, the inevitable to-be-done list after moving in, and the phony choices available from builders who promise custom homes but then load on as standard equipment many features of little interest to buyers. Wilson soon realized that that was exactly what he had been asking his customers to go through. By contrast, older home customers could clearly see what they were getting, buy only what they wanted, and often move in immediately. No wonder I was losing 78% of my potential customers. To create a hassle-free experience to go with the house itself, these together constituting Wilson's product, it was necessary to rethink every step in the process. He opened a one-stop sales center where the customer can see and decide on every option available in a house. For example, the 40 different varieties of brick, the 3,000 varieties of wallpaper, the 4 styles of built-in home office. Customize a basic design with the help of an AutoCAD computer system. Select features beyond the standard level, for example, extra thick carpet pads, additional outdoor lighting, and heavier duty wiring. Determine the exact price, work out the mortgage, arrange for insurance, and arrange for the title search. For customers truly in a hurry, this can be done during one walkthrough of the sales center. To shrink the lead time from contract signing to moving in from 6 months to a target of 30 days, he reorganized his contract writing and job release process and developed a system of pull scheduling for contractors who are assigned new jobs as downstream jobs are completed. He also introduced standardized work statements, parts lists, and toolkits for every job. Eventually, these steps will eliminate the to-do list because the new system does not allow the next task to start until the previous task is certified as complete with perfect quality. Finally, Wilson created a wide range of basic home designs with a minimum construction standard and asked the customer to specify all materials and system upgrades using the computer design system to a selected base design so the customer only pays for exactly what she or he feels is really needed. Doing all this is not easy, but Doyle Wilson has already made the key leap. Instead of concentrating on conventional markets and what he and his contractors were accustomed to making in a conventional way, he looked hard at value, as defined by his customers, and set off down a new path. Start by challenging traditional definitions of value. Why is it so hard to start at the right place to correctly define value? Partly because most producers want to make what they are already making, and partly because many customers only know how to ask for some variant of what they are already getting. They simply start in the wrong place and end up at the wrong destination. Then, when providers or customers decide to rethink value, they often fall back on simple formulas. Lower cost, increased product variety through customization, instant delivery. Rather than jointly analyzing value, in challenging old definitions to see what's really needed. Steve Maynard, Vice President for Engineering and Product Development at the Wiremold Company in West Hartford, Connecticut, was trying to deal with these very problems when he reorganized Wiremold's product development system in 1992. For many years previously, Wiremold had developed new products consisting of wire guides for office and industrial users and surge protectors for PCs and other business electronics through conventional departmentalized processes. It started with marketing, which commissioned surveys comparing Wiremold's products with the offerings of competitors. When an opportunity was identified, usually a gap in the market or a reported weakness in a competitor's offering, a design was developed by product engineering, then tested by the prototype group. If it worked according to specification, the design proceeded to the engineers designing the machines to make the products and eventually went into production. This system produced designs which lacked imagination and which customers often ignored. Simply speeding up this process through simultaneous engineering and then broadening product variety would just have brought more bad designs to market faster. Pure Muda. Steve Maynard's solution was to form a team for each product to stick with that product during its entire production life. This team, consisting of a marketer, a product engineer, and a tooling process engineer, proceeded to enter into a dialogue with leading customers, major contractors, in which all of the old products and solutions were ignored. Instead, the customer and the producer, Wiremold, focused on the value the customer really needed. Here's one example. Wiremold wire guides channel wiring through hostile factory environments and provide complex arrays of outlets in high-use areas like laboratories and hospitals. Traditionally, the guides had been designed almost entirely with regard to their ruggedness, safety, and cost per foot as delivered to the construction site. This approach nicely matched the mentality of Wiremold's product engineers, who dominated the development process and who found a narrow specification focus very reassuring. As the new dialogue began, it quickly developed that what customers also wanted was a product that looked nice and could be installed at the construction site very quickly. Wiremold had never employed a stylist and knew relatively little about trends in the construction process. Customers were willing to make substantial trades on cost per foot to get better appearance, which increased the bid price of construction jobs, and quicker installation, which reduced total cost. Within 2 years, as Wiremold's product families were given the team treatment, sales for these very conventional products increased by more than 40%, and gross margins soared. Starting over with a joint customer-producer dialogue on value paid a major dividend for Wiremold, quite aside from savings in product development and production cost. Steve Maynard's effort was one component of Wiremold's company-wide transformation to lean thinking, a transformation that brought incredible results, increased wages, double sales, and an upgraded physical plant. While Wiremold and every other firm needs to be searching for fundamentally new capabilities that will permit them to create value in unimagined dimensions, most firms can substantially boost sales immediately if they find a mechanism for rethinking the value of their core products to their customers. Define value in terms of the whole product. Another reason firms find it hard to get value right is that while value creation often flows through many firms, each one tends to define value in a different way to suit its own needs. When these differing definitions are added up, they often don't add up. Let's take another nightmarish but completely typical travel example. A few years ago, one of us, Jones, took his family on an Easter holiday in Crete from his home in Herefordshire in the United Kingdom. What was wanted was a total hassle-free package of transport to the airport, a flight to Crete, transport to the villa in Crete, and the villa itself. What was available instead was a product pieced together by the user and involving 19 different operating organizations. These were the travel company to book the air tickets in the villa, the taxi firm, which doesn't deal with the travel company, handling the long trip from Hereford to London Gatwick Airport. No airline flies nonstop between Birmingham, the nearest airport, and Crete at Easter time. The ground staffs at both airports, independent contractors to the airline. The security staffs at both airports, more independent contractors. The two customs staffs to check your documents at both ends and to keep themselves occupied doing so. The two airport authorities, who love long layovers because spending per passenger goes up. The airline, which has been disintegrating and performs less of the support activities for its operations itself. The air traffic authorities in 5 countries along the route of flight, who follow the standard form for governments by being undercapitalized and optimized for delays. The bank, exchanging currency at Gatwick Airport. The bus company to convey the family to the villa in Crete, and the villa. This is the box score of what the trip required. Total travel time, 13 hours. time actually going somewhere, 7 hours, 54% of the total. Queuing and wait time, 6 hours. Number of lines, 10. Number of times luggage was picked up and put down, 7. Number of inspections, all asking the same questions, 8. Total processing steps, 23. The problem here is not that there were too many firms involved. Each was appropriately specialized for its current task. The problem instead is that each firm was providing a partial product, often only looking inward toward its own operational efficiency, while no one was looking at the whole product through the eyes of the customer. The minute the focus is shifted to the whole, as seen by the customer, obvious questions emerge. Could one person at check-in handle the security, customs, and check-in task, letting you walk past into the boarding area or even onto the plane? Better yet, could the ticket sent by your travel agent include your baggage tags, boarding passes, taxi voucher, bus tickets, and villa registration, so that you just drop these off as you walk through each point? Or perhaps travelers could create their own ticket using their personal computer linked to a reservation system. They could simply swipe their credit card through a card reader at each point, eliminating paperwork along with the travel agent. Could the customs authorities in Crete have your passport scanned at check-in in London and use the hours you are en route to figure out whether you ought to be admitted? Then, unless there's a problem, you could just walk off the plane without visiting immigration and customs at all. In short, the appropriate definition of the product changes as soon as you begin to look at the whole through the eyes of the customer. The critical need for lean firms to rethink value. If you take a few moments to reflect on almost any product, a good, a service, or more likely both in combination, you will begin to see the same issue of the appropriate way to define it. Doing this will generally require producers to talk to customers in new ways, and for the many firms along a value stream to talk to each other in new ways. It's vital that producers accept the challenge of redefinition, because this is often the key to finding more customers, and the ability to find more customers and sales very quickly is critical to the success of lean thinking. This is because lean organizations, as we will demonstrate shortly, are always freeing up substantial amounts of resources. If they are to defend their employees and find the best economic use of their assets as they strike out on a new path, they need to find more sales right away. Beginning with a better specification of value can often provide the means. Then, once the initial rethinking of value is done, in what might be called kaikaku for value, lean enterprises must continually revisit the value question with their product teams to ask if they have really got the best answer. This is the value specification analog of Kaizen, which seeks to continually improve product development, order taking, and production activities. It produces steady results along the path to perfection. The final element in value definition, the target cost. The most important task in specifying value once the product is defined is to determine a target cost based on the amount of resources and effort required to make a product of given specification and capabilities if all the currently visible muda were removed from the process. Doing this is the key to squeezing out the waste. Conventional firms set target selling prices based on what they believe the market will bear. They then work backwards to determine acceptable cost to ensure an adequate profit margin, and they must do this any time they begin to develop a new product. So what's different here? Lean enterprises look at the current bundles of pricing and features being offered customers by conventional firms, and then ask how much cost they can take out by full application of lean methods. They effectively ask, what is the muda-free cost of this product once unnecessary steps are removed and the process is made to flow? This becomes the target cost for the development. Because the target is certain to be far below the cost borne by competitors, the lean enterprise has choices. Reduce prices, another way to increase sales volume and utilize freed-up resources. Add features are capabilities to the product, which should also increase sales. Add services to the physical product to create additional value and jobs. Expand the distribution and service network, again increasing sales, although with a time lag. Or take profits to underwrite new products, which will increase sales in the longer term. Once the target cost is set for a specific product, it becomes the lens for examining every step in the value stream for product development, order taking, and production, this latter being called operations in the case of a service like insurance or transportation. As we'll soon see, the relentless scrutiny of every activity along the value stream, that is, asking whether a specific activity really creates any value for the customer, becomes the key to meeting the aggressive cost target. The value stream. The view from the aisle. An excellent spot for observing the value stream is the aisle of the supermarket, for it is here that 1,000 streams empty into the arms of the customer. Not only does the flow of the physical product culminate in the supermarket aisle, as pulled forward by the decisions of the shopper, but also the process of product development as new products are launched. Indeed, Taichi Ono found this vantage point in the modern supermarket so stimulating that it inspired him in 1950 to invent the new system of flow management we now call just-in-time. Recently, we have been putting ourselves in the aisle in collaboration with the British grocery chain Tesco and a number of its suppliers to think through the value stream for specific products in a search for Muda. To do this, we have started to map out every step, each individual action, involved in the process of physical production and order taking for specific products. We have started to think about product development as well. Our method is based on a simple premise. Just as activities that can't be measured can't be properly managed, the activities necessary to create, order, and produce a specific product, which can't be precisely identified, analyzed, and linked together, cannot be challenged, improved, or eliminated altogether, and eventually perfected. The great majority of management attention has historically gone to managing aggregates, processes, departments, firms, overseeing many products at once. Yet what's really needed is to manage whole value streams for specific goods and services. Our initial objective in creating a value stream map, identifying every action required to design, order, and make a specific product, is to sort these actions into three categories. 1. Those which actually create value as perceived by the customer. 2. Those which create no value, but are currently required by the product development, order filling, or production systems. Type 1 Muda, and so can't be eliminated just yet. And 3, those actions which don't create value as perceived by the customer, type 2 Muda, and so can be eliminated immediately. Once this third set has been removed, the way is clear to go to work on the remaining non-value creating steps through use of the flow, pull, and perfection techniques described in the chapters ahead. The value stream for a carton of cola. The only way to make this method clear is to describe a typical value stream analysis. We'll use a product chosen more or less at random in the beverages aisle at Tesco, a cardboard carton of 8 cans of cola. We should, however, tell you at the outset that what we will find is fairly horrific, a lengthy set of actions extending over 300 days, most of which consume resources but create no value, and are therefore Muda. You should understand that looking at any of the 30,000 other items in the typical Tesco store would produce very much the same result. The cola example is neither better nor worse than the norm. You should also bear in mind that the firms arrayed along the cola value stream are all competently managed in terms of mass production thinking. The problem is not the competence of the managers operating the system in accord with an agreed logic. The problem is the logic itself. Producing cola. Even the mightiest river has modest headwaters. For cola, one of these is literally water, supplied in the United Kingdom by the local water authorities. Other basic ingredients are the essence, in plain language, the taste, used in tiny amounts and supplied as a concentrate by the parent cola company, beets for sugar, corn for caramels to provide the cola color and additional taste, fir trees for cardboard to make the carton, and bauxite or recycled cans to create aluminum for the can. The first step is to mine bauxite in Australia, which involves scooping out millions of tons of bauxite at a go in accord with a long-term production forecast. The mountain of ore is then transferred to massive trucks for shipment to a nearby chemical reduction mill, where the bauxite is reduced to powdery alumina. This process, which turns 4 tons of bauxite into 2 tons of aluminum, requires about 30 minutes. When enough alumina is accumulated to fill an ultra-large ore carrier, over 2 weeks or so, about 500,000 tons, or enough for 10 million cans, it is shipped by sea, a 4-week trip, to Norway or Sweden, countries with cheap hydroelectric power for smelting. After about a 2-month wait at the smelter, the application of an enormous amount of energy, 20 times that needed to melt down and recycle old cans, reduces 2 tons of alumina to 1 ton of aluminum in about 2 hours. Again, scale and smelting dictates that large amounts of aluminum be treated in each batch, with the molten aluminum poured into dozens of ingots 1 meter on each side and 10 meters long. These are then carefully cooled and stored for about 2 weeks before shipment by truck, boat, and truck to a hot rolling mill in Germany or Sweden. After about 2 weeks of storage at the hot rolling mill, the ingot is heated to 500 degrees centigrade and run through a set of heavy rollers 3 times to reduce the thickness from 1 meter to 3 millimeters. The actual rolling process takes about 1 minute, but the machinery is extremely complex and difficult to change from one specification of product to another, so management has found it best to wait until there are orders in hand for a large amount of material of a given specification, and then to process these orders all at once. When this is done for the specification of aluminum needed for cola cans, the aluminum sheet emerging from the rolling mill is wound onto a 10-ton coil and taken to a storage area, where it sits for about 4 weeks. When needed for the next step, the coil is taken from storage and shipped by truck to a cold rolling mill, either in Germany or Sweden, where it is stored for about another 2 weeks. Cold rolling squeezes the aluminum sheet from 3 millimeters to 3/10 of a millimeter, the thickness needed by can makers. Because the cold rolling equipment is also extremely expensive and difficult to change over to the next product, the managers of the cold rolling mills have also found it most economical to accumulate orders for products of a given specification and to do them all at once. The thin sheet emerging from the cold roller is then slit into narrower widths, wound onto 10-ton coils, and stored for about a month on average.